You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn why thousands of people were chanting and praying in Wisconsin's North Woods last week. First, after ousting dictator Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who had been in power for 30 years, the people of Sudan hoped to push the country toward democracy to replace an authoritarian leader who many held responsible for economic hardship and genocide. But instead of a peaceful transition of power, things quickly turned violent after military forces who had seized control of the country clashed with protesters demanding civilian rule. Military forces reject the protesters' pleas for a civilian government and used violence to disperse a protest in front of the country's military headquarters. Sudanese doctors reported 128 deaths in the aftermath of the protest. As of this weekend, there's a reported deal between military and civilian leaders to share power until the next elections. Amal Hassan Fadlallah is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan and author of the recent book on Sudan titled Branding Humanity, Competing Narratives of Rights, Violence, and Global Citizenship. Amal, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think Sudan as a country sometimes goes under the radar in the American media. Amal, can you take us back to Omar Hassan al-Bashir, his tenure as leader of Sudan and his overthrow?
Yes. President Bashir ruled the country for 30 years. I mean, that's the longest, military rule in the country, because before that we had, in the 60s, a dictator who ruled for 6 years, and then we had another one, Jafar Numeri, who ruled for 16 years. So this is the longest dictatorship in the Sudan. And a lot of things happened during Omar al-Bashir's reign. So there was war between the north and the south, which ended by, splitting the country in two. So now we have Sudan and South Sudan. And then, of course, everybody knows about the atrocities of war in Darfur, which, I'm still not resolved to this date. So lots of conservative rhetoric about, how Islam is the only kind of, discourse that, shaped the identities of people there. And people didn't like that because Sudan is a very diverse country, so it cannot be ruled by one ideology. So all of that resulted in this, protest against him at the end. And the leaders or people who led this protest are very young, and they all grew up under his reign. So, which tell us a lot about, how you can't silence people for a long time.
Now, there are echoes of the Arab Spring just to the north, where there were initial hopes after overthrowing a dictatorship and then a military rule and then people souring on that military rule. What's happened between the overthrow of Bashir and today?
You're right about the Arab Spring, because a lot of people cited the Arab Spring during the protest. And one reason is why, because this young generation, that the Arab Spring or the protests that led to the Arab Spring are stolen at the end. That's why they were adamant to stay occupy the streets until they get a response from the military council, which, of course, after the massacre, it took a horrible turn, and people thought, okay, people are not going to come back to the streets again. But they did overcome that violence, and they came with a lot of force, more than before, and which, led to the deal that you just talked about.
And talk about that deal. It's provisional. I don't know if it's a done deal until we see it happen, but does this give you hope that we'll not see another massacre like the one you just mentioned?
You're so right. I mean, a lot of people, I was talking to people the talk about this deal, and a lot of people are skeptical and some people have hope. So people are split. But again, when you think about the history of Sudan, that it has been, governed by military for almost 52 years. I mean, this is like the most possible deal that the two can agree on. And I think it gives people hope that it's also might be monitored by, you know, the AU, by, you know, international, other international groups, and also by national, you know, leaders in the Sudan. So we, I'm waiting to, I think tomorrow will be the day when they will sign it. And the deal would tell us a lot of things about who's who, you know, what does it mean to have, you know, the military, you know, lead this transitional period for 21 months. And then the 18 months would be for the freedom and change leadership. So I'm hoping, you know, that, you know, would clarify a lot of things.
Amal Hassan Fadlallah is with us, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Michigan, looking at the latest news in Sudan. Has the United States played a big role since the overthrow of Bashir in Sudan, Amal?
Yes, I think, you know, I have to say, I mean, the role of the U.S. is very positive thus far, that, you know, they send an envoy to the Sudan, Donald Booth, who knows Sudan very well. And they also send Tibor Nagy, who is Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. And the, their message is very clear that, you know, we will support, you know, a very smooth transfer to civilian rule. And then also the European Union send very kind of positive, you know, messages to the military council. So, yeah, I mean, it's very positive. And I think people were, you know, kind of very worried about that, but now they feel very comfortable about this positive role.
There were concerns about the role of Saudi Arabia in funding the successor to Bashir's regime, maybe helping install some of his lieutenants, henchmen in power instead. Has Saudi Arabia and their conservative version of Islam that they promote played a big role in Sudan?
Yes, I mean, and people were very scared at the beginning because when, you know, the military council was delaying the negotiation, they were actually, you know, seemed like they're establishing themselves. So they, you know, visited Saudi Arabia and United Emirates, put a lot of money in the, you know, central bank, and people got worried about their role. But later on in the game, there was a meeting I heard in Berlin where, you know, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Egypt were part of this meeting. And all of them kind of agreed that the best way to get out of this is to support a peaceful transfer to a civilian rule, because I don't think, you know, any of them need, you know, violence in that region, or so it's in their interest to have a peaceful neighbor.
Amal, I understand you got your degree, or at least a couple of your degrees, at the University of Khartoum, the capital of Sudan. What are you hearing on a personal level from people in the middle of all of this?
Well, you know, I am an anthropologist, so Sudan has been my focus for a long time. And the book that just came out actually focused on activism in the Sudan and in the diaspora. And it's very interesting that, you know, people have been talking about this revolution for a long time and they've been mobilizing, but the protests keep getting crushed. So I was hoping to, you know, have the book end with the revolution, but unfortunately that didn't happen. So now this is another book. So I am here, I'm following closely, and I'm hearing that people are, well, they put up a tough fight, to tell you the truth. I've been, you know, following. And now there is very, you know, there is this sense of anxiety about what is going to happen next. And of course, people who are skeptical, people who are afraid, there is this sense of mistrust. It's the military. How could we sit with them and make a deal with them after the massacre? And so there is all of this. But I'm also hearing that there is solidarity groups now. So there is this group that is called Keep an Eye on Sudan. It's a global solidarity, which, you know, is aiming at, you know, kind of following with Sudanese after the signing of this deal. So people shouldn't be, you know, scared in that sense, that there will be monitors, international monitors. They will also be using the card of the revolution. So the revolution is not done yet. A lot of them, I'm hearing some of the chants that say that the revolution has just begun.
Amal, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Amal Hassan Fadlala. She is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan and author of the book Branding Humanity, Competing Narratives of Rights, Violence, and Global Citizenship. She joined us today to talk about political protests in Sudan and apparent deal there between military and civilian leaders. Coming up, we check out a massive, loosely organized peace gathering in Wisconsin's North Woods this weekend. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we tend to associate concussions with men in sports. Research shows women and girls may be more likely than men and boys to get concussions, especially while playing soccer. Look at what our guest says, and is an unpublicized epidemic. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about land conservation.
Taking care of the land can be a huge responsibility, chock full of hard work and ethical dilemmas. Writer Bill Leaders shares his own experience in managing his property.
A little more than a decade ago, my wife and I acquired a 13-acre parcel of mostly wooded land in Richland County. On one of our first visits, a neighbor asked about our intentions. "Put up a small cabin," I said. "Take care of the land." And that's what we've done. You're here with me now. You can hear what it sounds like. We make the trek to Madison about 30 weekends a year, in all seasons. Our cabin is Amish built and wood heated, with electricity but no running water. It's the land that draws us. We put in trails delineated with logs and maintained with weed whackers. We've worked to maximize the woodland's growth potential, largely by removing trees that are less desirable, like the abundant ash trees that face annihilation by the emerald ash borer. And we've tried to get rid of the invasives, all of them. Briars, prickly ash, multiflora rose, Japanese barberry. I have pulled tens of thousands of these by hand. That's not an exaggeration. I try to yank out the roots, knowing that the ones that don't come out all the way will come back again. It's a never-ending battle. Every year, there are fewer invasives, but always there are some. It makes me think of Zeno's paradox. If I cut the number of invasives in half every year, I'll never get to zero. It's maddening. Taking care of the land is a lot of work. My chainsaw gets much more use than my hammock. And frankly, it involves a lot of killing. Yanking plants, felling trees, blasting away weeds with a wildly whipping piece of plastic string. It can be very violent. A path is kept open by killing. But the truth is that it's not good for the land to be left alone. Not when invasives are ready to turn it into a prickly bramble. Not when trees doomed to die are competing against ones that can thrive. Forestry is about making life and death decisions. This tree can live. That one must go. It's an enormous responsibility, full of ethical dilemmas. There's an ash tree on our land, about 50 feet long. It is not 50 feet tall. Several years ago, the trunk cracked about 4 feet from the ground. The trunk is now horizontal. It lies across a small stream that runs through the property. Last year, when we had our 7th 100-year flood in the last 12 years, you do the math, the top of the tree ended up being covered with dirt. It now begins and ends underground, its branches extending straight upward, perpendicular to the fallen trunk, reaching for the sky. This is not a quality tree. It will never be healthy. It will never be good timber. It should probably be removed to make room for trees that are more desirable. I will never do that. Look at what this tree has managed to do, to stay alive against all odds. Look at how it gallantly extends its limbs skyward, despite its shattered spine and buried top. Look at how it clings tenaciously to life. and then the flood last summer, this fallen but living ash tree served as a dam to block debris that would otherwise have clogged my neighbor's culvert. It served a useful purpose. We removed the debris. This spring, the branches that remain again erupted in leaves. The tree is still alive. We'll take care of it.
Bill Leaders is editor of The Progressive, a magazine based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, thousands of people from far and wide made their way last week to Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest, not for fireworks and s'mores. It was the annual gathering of the Rainbow Family of Living Light. The loosely organized event brought a lot of people to the region near the city of Iron River. WPR's Superior-based reporter Danielle Kading was there. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. I think I did see s'mores at the gathering.
Okay. We will correct that in post. So now, Danny, before we get to what this thing was, just paint us a picture for people who weren't here, because this is a kind of a vivid scene.
Okay. It's about an hour hike to get there, first off. It's on a forest road, and you hike into this open meadow. And when you get there, at the height of the 4th of July ceremony, everybody's holding hands across this vast meadow. There must be hundreds of people. You know, there were at least 5,000 people there on that day. And they're all holding hands, and they're just saying, "Om," and they're humming like that for what seemed like 15 minutes. And they're all wearing tie-dye, and some had elaborate costumes. Like, one had a rainbow-colored jester outfit carrying a flat disco ball. I saw Gumby. Some people were wearing nothing at all. And they're just observing this moment of peace and meditation. And then when that ends, they just erupt into cheers and celebration and begin dancing and playing music and hugging one another and saying, "I love you." And it was unlike anything else I've ever seen.
This is not a household name, I think, this group. Who are the Rainbow Family of Living Light?
Yeah, the Rainbow Family of Living Light is a loose-knit group. They've been meeting every year in a national forest since 1972. And they have no official leaders. They pretty much rely on one another for the things they need, like food or water or medical supplies when they're at the gathering. People can donate during dinner circles at night to help fund expenses. But they rely on each other a lot.
You talked to some people about this gathering. What kind of things did you hear from participants who journeyed to Wisconsin?
You know, a lot of them shared in that idea of love and peace and unity being a common thread, knitting them all together. Others, they all kind of took away their own meaning from the gathering. One person I talked to, Jeffrey Carpenter of Baltimore, Maryland, he went by the rainbow name Yona, and he said that it welcomed people as they are.
So if you want to be a nudist, that's cool. If you want to be a train punk, that's cool too. If you want to be like a hard Krishna, you want to be like anything, like it's all kind of wide open. It feels like for me, it just feels like a large, like, no judgment zone.
Is that a general gist you got from people who were there?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of them felt like this was a place where people accepted them, where they knew they were going to be treated well, and that if they needed anything, somebody was going to be there for them. You know, I was hiking back out of the woods after collecting sound for the day, and I came across a woman, and she said, you know, "A couple of people just helped me get my car out of the mud," because it was raining, and the forest roads, you know, tend to be dirt roads. So she said, "I think I'm going to go back for more." So there was this idea that, you know, they were kind of getting rejuvenated by being together and sharing in this idea of peace and unity and love.
So this is in national forests around the country, this time in northern Wisconsin. What did you hear from local people? I think local communities kind of dwarfed by this large gathering.
Yeah, think people, some local people in town were skeptical of the Rainbow family. One cashier I talked to, Abby Nelson at O'Brien's Sea Store in Iron River, said shops were keeping a close eye after reports of some Rainbow members shoplifting.
Were there any arrests or other types of incidents along the way?
Oh, yes. Also, Bayfield County Sheriff Paul Susenka said that there were about 30 arrests, but he said that all in all, things seem to go pretty smoothly.
Is this the sort of event that they would welcome back to the Iron River area, do you think, from what you heard?
You know, I think there's mixed feelings on that. I think some people were happy to see the extra business that it brought in and people shopping at their stores and, you know, the concept that they were working on, you know, peace and love and unity. I think other people felt that it brought nothing but trouble.
And I understand we'll hear more from this. Danielle, you're going to work on a Wisconsin Life piece about the Rainbow Gathering event.
Yes, yes. I will be doing a piece for Maureen McCollum, and I'm looking forward to it.
Danny, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. We talked to her today about last week's Rainbow Gathering. It drew thousands of people to Wisconsin's North Woods. Coming up, we'll look at the high risk of concussions in women's soccer and why our guest says it's not getting the attention it deserves. She's calling for, among other things, more research into the way concussions impact women and girls in athletics. And you can get in there now with maybe your story, your experience, your observations. If you played, if you parented, if you coached, you can email us right now at ideas@wpr.org with your experiences and your questions. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, get the latest in the long-running back and forth about wolves and the endangered species list with a Wisconsin conservation expert. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Women's World Cup is over with the U.S. defeating the Netherlands in the finals yesterday 2-0. That could inspire a new generation of girls and boys to join the game. And if you have daughters in particular who play, our next guest says you may want to know more about their risk of concussion. It might be higher than you think. Research shows that women and girls may face a higher risk of concussions than men and boys, and they may also experience more severe concussions and take longer to recover. And our guest says it's not just the headers that are behind these injuries. Tracy Sneddon is a pediatric nurse and assistant professor in the School of Nursing at UW-Madison. She specializes in adolescent concussions, sports safety, injury prevention and recovery, and overall student health and well-being. Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, you wrote a piece about this for USA Today. What is it that most of us might not know about girls and women and athletic concussions?
Yeah, I think the point of that piece was to bring awareness that women and girls in soccer do actually incur a fair amount of concussion that we don't often speak about. Often the media, the attention in both science and other, is placed on the contact sports that men or boys play, most specifically football and ice hockey. So I think more than anything, it was just to bring awareness to the general public about there is a lot going on with our girls and our women who are playing soccer.
Before we get more into the risks, you mentioned in your piece you have a daughter who played at UW-Madison. Your message is not soccer is dangerous, don't do it.
You're absolutely correct. I think any physical activity for our kids, our youth, our young adults is really important. So that's not at all what I'm trying to inspire. We do have two sons who played ice hockey, also a high concussion risk, and a daughter, as you say, who played here at Madison women's soccer. So very important to keep our kids active.
That said, what don't we know? What do we need more research on when it comes to girls and women and concussions?
Yeah, I think there's been a number of studies at the high school and the college level that have told us that the rate of concussion in women and girls is higher when compared to men. Specifically in soccer, we have seen some studies say as much as 3 times higher at the high school level than in boys and men. So what we don't know is why that might be occurring. And there's a couple, you know, hypotheses as scientists and as others that tell us those might be the reason. One could just be sheer physiological. Their neck structure, their ligaments aren't as strong as some of the men and boys that we're comparing to. Potentially, it's a matter of culture, and that women and girls are more apt to report their concussions than maybe our boys and our men are. And third, is there, you know, some underlying hormonal connection or some genetic component that actually is causing more concussions? More work is needed in all those areas.
I understand we have at least some preliminary brain scanning that's going on that says, hey, maybe it is more than that second option you mentioned, that girls are more likely to report or be reported. Maybe something different is happening in the brain.
Yeah, I think just some early work's been done. They've been small studies with small samples, not a lot to really bring a strong association to, and that's where more work needs to be done. And I think we're seeing some of those studies that are starting to gain some momentum. I mentioned in my piece specifically, there's a large study that's funded by the NCAA and Department of Defense that's looking at hundreds of concussions, both from, like you're describing, head scans to blood draws, signs and symptoms, and trying to really get a sense of what that might look like.
Talking to Tracy Sneddon, pediatric nurse and assistant professor in the School of Nursing at UW-Madison, looking at the risk of concussion in sports, specifically for girls and women in soccer. She says there's more research that needs to be done. Part of the changes that seem to be happening in youth sports more and more seems to be what happens after that first head injury, how long you keep the kid off the field. Are you seeing a culture change there in girls soccer and other youth sports?
That's a loaded question. And I think, you know, amidst what we've been watching through the weeks for World Cup, mm-hmm. it comes down to what are the protocols? What are the standards? What are the guidelines for the level of play that's occurring? So we have a pretty good sense on what goes on at the pro level, the NCAA level. They have, you know, supposedly well-established guidelines and protocols. What we don't really have a good sense of is at the youth level and who's diagnosing, who's supervising, what their recovery looks like, when are they being returned to the field? And I think the greater question is even, are they playing other sports or for another team at the same time? So who's really monitoring when they're placed back on the field and what is their risk level?
What do we know about the health risks of that second concussion soon after the first one?
Yeah, I think that's our greatest concern. And what we see from the literature and from the science is that generally, although it's rare, and generally what we see is that it's in the ages less than 18 years, they are pretty significant, that second impact syndrome, as we call it. And what ensues when someone who is not fully recovered at the brain level sustains another hit to the head, that generally results in significant cerebral swelling or edema that often results in death before our very eyes on the pitch, on the field, on the basketball court, wherever that might be.
And we had this scary moment in the World Cup game yesterday. Kelly O'Hara of the American team had that head-to-head contact with one of the Dutch players. They were off the field. They were back on the field before halftime. And then it looks like there's more evaluation, and O'Hara then was subbed in the second half. That had some people scratching their heads, like, why was she back out on the field that quickly?
Yeah, so I think this is a continuing question in all of sports, especially those who are played on the big stage, where millions and millions of people are, you know, making their own opinion, taking their own notes about how things should be handled. In this case, no matter what, the players were removed for evaluation and potential treatment, and then in this case, they were placed back on the field minutes after evaluation. So the tricky thing with concussion is we evaluate a couple different things. We looked at the mechanism of injury, and as everyone who was watching this hit, likely their jaw dropped. It was a substantial hit. They were on the ground for a number of minutes. So mechanism itself already tells us a lot about the injury. But what we don't always know is the signs and symptoms. Do they occur immediately? Often they occur minutes, hours, even days later. And then we don't have the sense of reporting. You know, we're relying on the athlete themselves to give us a sense of, are they okay? Are you feeling this or that? So there's a little bit of mud here since we don't have a objective way to diagnose and identify concussion. So, you know, that's a very loaded question today. We're seeing it all over the media, on Twitter. Everyone is making a call on, was that appropriate? Was it not? Did FIFA make a mistake? What is the protocol for concussion in, you know, that area of soccer? Is it a substitution issue, because there are a very limited number of substitutions at the FIFA level? And is that playing into the handling of injuries all, not just concussion at that level.
One cultural change I think I'm seeing, and I've seen other people write about this, if you look at NFL commentary during games, it used to be, hey, this player, the guy in this case, they're tough. They took a tough hit to the head, and they're back out there. Wow, awesome. And now I think the language is changing, I hope at the youth level too. Is that something you see, that it's not a sign of toughness to go back out there after that head hit?
Gosh, another great question, Rob. So what we saw yesterday was the pure response from the public, and even at the time, of wow, she went back in after that substantial hit. She actually returned to the field. But not long after, in the second half of that game, there was another substantial hit between a U.S. and a Netherlands player, and that individual actually was bleeding on the time of the field and came off quickly for treatment and assessment, actually had her head bandaged and returned back to the field. The reaction in the media was completely different for those two scenes. So the first one, the media was surprised and somewhat disappointed, and even the general public, that individual is allowed to return back. And many of the postings for the person who came back with the head bandage actually was somewhat commended for how tough she is and what an amazing athlete that they're able to come back. So I think we still have some work to do on, you know, getting to the point you're describing.
What would you like to see as guidelines, especially for younger players, girls and boys, I guess, for that matter, when it comes to soccer and heading the ball?
Okay. Well, we know that heading the ball itself isn't the primary cause of injury for what we're seeing for concussions. It's often related to the field itself, falling back, hitting the goal in some way, hitting another player's shoulder or head, as we saw yesterday in that game multiple times. So, you know, what do we need to do? And I think USA Soccer has already placed a limit on who can head and who can't. So we're seeing some of that that was being made really with not a lot of evidence, but it's a very nice, safe decision for USA Soccer. But what else needs to be done? I think we have to have a better sense of recognition. And as I described at the youth level, it's not always common to have a medical personnel on the field. So sometimes it's a parent or a trained medical person in the crowd that's making these evaluations. And I think if we can get to a point where we have greater coverage of somebody being able to diagnose and evaluate, is really important.
Do we need to train coaches more at the youth sports level, soccer and other sports, to do concussion protocols?
Education is always important, but often these concussion protocols don't even exist.
What do you mean?
Well, there is probably, it's not probably, there is known evidence that there are some organizations or leagues or whatever whose maybe their concussion policy isn't well known to everyone. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't exist in the coach's mind.
I see.
Maybe they're trained on how to recognize and what to do, meaning remove them. But what does that protocol look like after the youth player goes back home and is in the care of the parents and maybe the primary care provider? How do they make their way back on?
We're talking about head injuries in women's and girls' soccer and other sports with Tracy Sneddon. She's a pediatric nurse and an assistant professor in the School of Nursing at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a current or former soccer player yourself, youth or otherwise? Are you the parent or coach of soccer players? Do you worry a lot about the risk of concussions? Any girls or women out there in particular who have played the game, do you want to share your concerns or experiences, what you'd like to see happening on the sidelines? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about concussions and female athletes, especially in the sport of soccer. Tracy Sneddon is a pediatric nurse practitioner and an assistant professor in the School of Nursing at UW-Madison. She wrote a piece in USA Today about the issue, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have daughters who play soccer? Do you coach, or have you coached girls soccer? Have you played yourself? Do you worry about head injuries, developing problems later in life? What happens on the sidelines when there is that head injury? How do coaches handle this? How do parents handle this? And do you have questions about head injuries and soccer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Tracy, I see sometimes this headgear that some soccer players wear. Does that do anything? Do we know if that's effective?
Another good question from you, Robin. You know, just recently, a large study occurred here at the University of Wisconsin. My colleagues actually led by Tim McGuine, led this study that actually prospectively or enrolled individuals wearing different kinds of headgear. There was close to 3,000 high school soccer players that were monitored across two seasons. And out of that two seasons, 130 of them sustained concussions. Those 130, some of them had headgear on, some of them didn't. And they compared whether it was effective in decreasing concussion itself or decreasing the severity. And surprisingly to many, there was absolutely no change, no association between the wearing of headgear and the reduction of concussion. So I think we still have a lot to learn on what can change concussion rate and risk, but the headgear did not show a strong correlation.
I've seen there have been some new grants or donations to help fund research for women in soccer, women in sports in particular. What do we see going on out there?
Yeah, so I think finally women are getting some attention for some large funding. Specifically, the most recent funding came from the CLF, or an organization that actually focuses on long-term effects, even CTE, most specifically usually in the male and the football population. So it's really promising to see some dollars that are finally going to women to take a look at those long-term effects and potential associations with CTE.
In your column in USA Today, you start off telling the story of retired soccer great Abby Wambach. Can you share her experience a little bit?
Yeah, so I think, as you read that story, you could kind of get a feel for something we've seen over the past weeks watching the World Cup. And that was, for Abby, she had had a number of concussions. And when I described that specifically, she was playing in the pro leagues, and she did sustain a hit where she did lay on the ground for a number of minutes. Officially, the referee didn't determine it a severe injury. She might have told the referee she didn't need anyone. And she continued play. She stood up, wobbly, continued play. The extra time was added, and she continued to play through the game. Her final play in the game was actually another header, where after the whistle was blown, she dropped to the ground on her knees and appeared to be in duress, and somewhat not in good shape. So the team of trainers rushed out, and away she went. She was handled internally by the team and by, in that case, U.S. Soccer, and they admitted days later that that concussion or that head injury was not well handled. So they did actually, admit that they could have handled it better, which was a substantial stride for what we're seeing. But we're still seeing things like that occurring. And is it the role of the athlete? Is it the role of the management team, the referee on the field? We've got a lot of work to do.
That highlights the idea that self-evaluation by the player is not going to be very reliable, I think, because one, you've taken a head injury, you're confused.
Mm-hmm.
You're not literally in your right mind at that moment. To the extent that players are sometimes, they're players, they want to stay in the game. They have a motive to err on the side of, I can still play.
Absolutely. And we've seen that already in a multitude of studies, most specifically studies at the high school football level that have been done anonymously. And those numbers are as high as 60% of them have admitted that they've not come forward with a concussion at the time of injury. Because, like you said, they're wanting to stay on the field, wanting to stay on the team, wanting to not look like whatever name we'd like to use. And we'll say cleanly, a wimp. So there's a lot playing into that. And I think at the female level, it also has, especially at the elite levels.
Talking about concussions and sports, specifically women and girls playing soccer and the risks that they can face and the uncertainties, what we don't know about concussions. Still time for you to join in with your questions and experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You mentioned that many sports, youth sports, don't have a concussion protocol, or if they do, coaches might not even know about it. What should be there? What information should be in every youth coach's and referee's hands when it comes to concussions?
I think we could use the model of the NCAA, which has done a very nice job coming up with a protocol that includes attention to safety. And we've also seen it from the CDC in their recent initiatives that have asked us to remove and evaluate. And finally, a lot of the U.S., actually every single state in the United States, has a concussion law that has a lot of these components. So what would that protocol look like? And I think first and foremost, it's assessing the individual and removing them from play immediately to be assessed in a quiet area. Secondly, that individual should not be returned to play at the same during the same game on the same day. And that's pretty well accepted across all laws. Another component of it, of course, is to have some sort of tiered return to play, as the NCAA and the NFL and many other high-profile organizations have. And I don't think we've seen that yet at the youth leagues, some sort of management where it's a graduated return to play. And I think that's because of the absence of medical personnel that are part of youth soccer and other sports.
We've been having conversations on this network for a lot of years now when it comes to concussions and sports. Do you feel frustrated with the slow pace of response that we seem to see in some sports?
Yeah, frustrated. I don't know if that's the word. I guess concern a little bit. I think we're making progress. I think, you know, what we're seeing is more attention to more than just single sports. We're seeing more attention to female injury. And so I would say I'm actually feeling positive about what we're seeing. Is it moving fast enough? Absolutely not. But not many things do unless there's substantial dollars and substantial attention to it. And I think we're finally getting that when we look at women's sports and we look at other sports besides the most common high contact sports.
Are we getting to a stage, staying on the positive note, maybe where girls in sports aren't an afterthought in this discussion?
I sure hope so. You know, that piece that you're referring to from USA Today did ask that we're launching large, you know, high enrollment studies that do look at females and their effects, both short and long term, instead of them being from studies that are ad hoc or post hoc looks at, well, how does the female look from the male? I think we're truly making some progress there, and I'm pleased about that.
In football in particular, there's concern not just about that one impact that you look at and say, oh, that was terrible, but the repetitive impact that, say, the linemen and linebackers have again and again. Is there a similar concern in soccer, even if there are a series of routine headers, say, that don't look bad, that don't cause immediate injury, that this could have a cumulative effect?
Yes, I think there's some great attention there, that what we're realizing is that relying on individuals to self-report concussion is actually relying on the wrong measure. We need to rely on individuals who are spending years in high contact, repetitive, high head impact sports. And what does that mean? There's been some work at the research level on accelerometers measuring gravity forces that these individuals are taking to their head. But we also know genetically every person is different. Someone might have a 3G hit to their head and be absolutely fine. Others are not. So you're absolutely right in looking at the cumulative impact of a number of years of those micro, subclinical concussions and what that might be.
I am also a parent of women's soccer players. My girls have played for about 11 years. I am probably more freaked out by the risk of concussion than anyone I know. It's been a tough balancing act for me on the sidelines as a parent. What is your advice as we wrap up for parents of daughters in particular getting into the game?
Yeah, so I think more than anything, we need to look at things that are going to affect the number of concussion. We know they're going to exist no matter what. It happens in all areas. And in soccer, we're going to see it to continue to occur from the hits that we described. But I think we need to focus on training our coaches, most specifically those parent-level coaches, giving them education to recognize concussion, ensuring that the drills and the practices are well supported for the youth, the developmental age that they are, and ensuring that parents are aware of what signs and symptoms look like after they leave the youth field.
Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation.
Tracy Sneddon is a pediatric nurse practitioner and an assistant professor in the School of Nursing at UW-Madison. Talked to her about head injuries and concussions among women soccer players, women and girls in the game. Still time for you to share your experiences. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a lot of people say they're turning away from the news in part because they're feeling worn out by negative stories. A media analyst joins the show for a look at recent survey results, and you can share your thoughts. There are more and more streaming TV services out there, and it's getting harder for consumers to figure out what's worth the money and the hassle. Our guest helps us sort out the market for online TV viewing. And cats. Wisconsin's local humane societies are working to provide good homes for cats, and a bunch of them are waiving their adoption fees in July for qualified cat caretakers. We'll get the details of how that's working around the state. That and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6:30, there are a lot of school buildings in Wisconsin and a lot of opportunities for energy conservation and renewable energy sources to power those buildings. Find out how Wisconsin schools are getting into the energy-saving game tomorrow at 7 on the morning show. Up next, news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk with a business psychologist who says incompetent men, and lots of them, are leading businesses and other organizations in the wrong direction. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.